This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Yesterday's opening ceremonies in Athens featured 4,000 performers, a 571-gallon temporary lake, and, of course, the ceremonial marching of 202 teams worth of Olympic competitors, all prelude to the competition that begins today. John Powers covers the Olympics for the Boston Globe, and he joins me now from Athens. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. I'm sure it's cooler there than it is here.
Well, probably a little bit, yes. You attended yesterday's opening ceremonies. Did they appropriately set the tone for the 2004 Games?
Yes, I think they did. One of the things that, from the minute you get off the plane here in Athens, there's a sign that says, "Welcome Home." And they have been driving the point home that this is where the Games began, this is where the Games were revived, and now everyone is back here where all of it happened. And everything they're doing, for example, the torch relay began at the Acropolis yesterday morning, finished in a brand new stadium. The men's road cycling race today goes around the Acropolis. Next week they'll be having the shot put up at Olympia. So there's the blending of old and new across 3,000 years, and that was the whole point of the opening ceremonies.
Doping and security issues have dominated the headlines in the months leading up to the Games. Now that they have begun, has the emphasis shifted to good old-fashioned competition, and does it remain there as far as you can tell?
Well, so far, the big issue about security, it's everywhere, but yet it isn't really intrusive. People are feeling safe. There's no sense of dread of apprehension. What is interesting, however, is that the doping issue continues to remain here. We saw this last night at the opening ceremonies. The person everybody thought was going to light the flame for Greece, which is Mr. Kenteris, who was the Olympic gold medalist in the 200, was a no-show. He may be banned for doping. So suddenly a windsurfer pops up out of nowhere. So this is an issue clearly that is going to be shadowing these Games, and I think people will be waiting for the first doping test to come in a few days to see what goes on.
John, you're currently at the swimming heat at which Michael Phelps qualified. What a surprise. So much attention has been paid to American swimmer Phelps. He's not the only member of the U.S. team, though.
No, exactly. And I think what was interesting here is when there was a press conference with the U.S. team, 90% of the questions were from Michael. And in a funny way, it takes the pressure off the other American swimmers here. I mean, this is going to be probably the best men's team since 1976. That team, of course, in Montreal won all gold medals but one. But you've got Brendan Hansen in the breaststroke. You've got Aaron Pearsall in the backstroke. You've got Ian Crocker of Portland, Maine in the butterfly. You've got world record holders in seven events here. So this is going to be clearly a very strong U.S. team. But until Michael Phelps doesn't win a race, that is going to be the major issue here. Michael swam very well today, well within himself. The other big thing of the morning was Ian Thorpe, the torpedo from Australia, who literally fell into the pool at his trials and only got here because of a gift from a teammate. The thing is, would he fall in the pool again? Actually, he jumped in. Everything was fine today for Ian.
Well, if Mr. Phelps doesn't come home with at least seven, if not eight, gold medals, does he become the Dan and Dave of this year's Olympics?
Well, that's what everyone is saying. And, of course, Michael has said, "I went to Sydney and came home with nothing. If I get one gold medal here, it's a great meet for me." I mean, that may be true. No one believes that. People actually said, "What if you win seven? Is that a major disappointment?"
I think, what a question!
Is it a major disappointment? Most people here feel that he will get four gold medals and possibly another four of some color. And, of course, the big issue here today is what will happen tomorrow with the men's 400 freestyle relay. Michael is not on it. He could be on it because anyone's eligible for it. And do you put them back on that relay? And that'll be the big question tomorrow. Watch after the morning heats. See who goes in the evening.
We'll be talking a little later to former gymnast Shannon Miller about the U.S. women's gymnastics team. But what about the men, John? Are they in contention for medals this time around?
Well, very much so. I think one of the overlooked stories here is that the Americans have a very good chance not only to win the first team medal since the 1984 team, but the first gold medal individually in the all-around with Paul Hamm ever. No one has done that, and he is the world champion coming in. The big question for the Americans is almost all of their great moments in gymnastics have come on home soil, whether it's the Magnificent Seven at the 96 Games or 84 or the World Championships last year. The question is, do they travel well? And that's what we'll know today. The U.S. men are going up in the prelims today. The women go up tomorrow. It is possible this is the best balanced team the Americans have ever had, both men and women.
On Thursday, the Iraqi men's soccer team upset the highly favored team from Portugal. Can we hope for more from this team, or is this one game enough for a nation in need of some really good news?
I think this is not a bad team. One of the things, because Iraq has had so many problems, people forget that this is one of the sports they are truly good in. And I don't know how much of the game was shown back home, but they dominated Portugal. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, they scored all four of their goals and one of Portugal's. But I think it was an amazing view of what happens with when the human spirit is unbound. I mean, people may have forgotten this, but Uday Hussein, who ran the Olympic Committee, also ran the Soccer Federation. Mm-hmm. And those athletes, when they didn't meet his standards, were especially tortured. This is a team that couldn't qualify at home because the stadium was in ruins. They had to go to Jordan all the time. This team may well be heard from, but I think it set a tone for these games that anything is possible.
Which Olympic athletes or what teams, U.S. or otherwise, that we haven't heard much from yet will be making headlines in days to come?
Well, the one team that's been completely overlooked, especially as the U.S. men's basketball team has struggled, is the U.S. women's basketball team. They're going for the third straight gold medal here. They are as much of a slam dunk, literally, as you're going to find in any team sport here, and no one has talked about them. As a matter of fact, one reason why they got noticed is that Dawn Staley, who was one of the team members, carried the flag in the opening ceremonies. Mm-hmm. But that, I would say, is a story that you will see come to the fore later when people remember, oh, yeah, they are here.
John Powers covers the Olympics for the Boston Globe. He's been only a games ringmaster in Lillehammer, Atlanta, Nagano, Sydney, and Salt Lake City. He joined us from Athens this time around. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Bill.
Opinion regarding Olympic security has been divided since long before security measures were implemented for the Games in Greece. Now that they've begun, that's still the case. Joanna Kakissis reports.
Fireworks lit up the night sky earlier this week as Greeks filled the streets, waved flags, sported Athens 2004 t-shirts, and watched the Olympic torch relay come through the small port town of Corinth. The Olympics are home again after more than 100 years. But these are also the first Summer Olympic Games since the terrorist attacks of September 11. Greece has spent almost $2 billion on security. The government has installed hundreds of cameras around Athens, and a surveillance blimp patrols the city skies every night. On a hot evening on the eve of the opening ceremonies, three neighbors in the central Athens neighborhood of Ano Patisia watched the blimp glide noisily across the dark sky. Aliki Marketu and her sister Kula Nitsia tell their neighbor, Christos Makas, that the blimp is something out of a fantasy. Look how it goes back and forth, they say. Look. It sees everything strange. Murders, burglaries. It must see everything. They say they feel safe. But they worry that for years, Athenians will pay for the staggering expense of Olympic security. The 37 Olympic venues are also guarded by hundreds of police officers, soldiers, and foreign troops. Police officers roam the city holding machine guns. Athenians like Kelly Stathopoulou say their city is one of the safest in the world. The 30-year-old lawyer has lived in Athens all her life. She says countries like the United States and Great Britain have been unfair about the security issue. Greece is doing the best it can, she says.
Well, I've always felt that Athens is a very secure city. Now there are so many security measures, so many policemen on the streets, on the metro stations, so I feel even safer.
Greek newspapers report that some Athenians feel like they are under siege and compare the security measures to those imposed during Athens' military dictatorship, which lasted from 1967 to 1974. But many Athenians are taking the measures in stride. Stathopoulou says the extra security measures have not strained her sense of independence.
I don't feel uncomfortable because I know that it is about the Olympic Games. I mean, if it would go on like that forever, it might feel a bit more like Big Brother. At the moment, I mean, everybody wants the Olympic Games to be a success, so everybody accepts that.
Lefteris Oikonomou, the spokesman for the Ministry of Public Order, says the country has done everything it can to make the Games safe and that the world should take the country's word that all will be well.
The measures are fully developed at this time, and every Greek and every visitor here has a chance to see for themselves that these measures are in full balance between security and celebration, and Athens in no way resembles a police state.
Athens Mayor Dora Bakoyani says the city will celebrate every night during the 2 weeks the Olympics are here. In a news conference earlier this week, she also insisted that security was not compromised because of last-minute preparations. Greek leaders like Bakoyani have tried hard to dispel Greece's image as a terrorist-friendly state. In the last 2 years, the government has captured, tried, and imprisoned the members of a once-notorious domestic terrorist group called the Revolutionary Organization 17 November. In the 3 decades of the group's existence, it killed more than 30 American, British, and Greek officials. Bakoyani was personally affected. The group also killed her husband, the journalist Pavlos Bakoyanis, 15 years ago. For the next 2 weeks, Bakoyani and her fellow Greeks will watch the games and hope the world will come to believe what they say they've known all along, that the Olympics belong here. For Only a Game, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
It's 18 minutes past the hour.
I die for my team!
In Athens, a German member of the International Olympic Committee has asked the IOC's Athletic Commission to check the T-shirts athletes are wearing. Walter Treuger told the IOC on Tuesday that he'd seen an athlete in a shirt that read, Blitzkrieg, it's only a game. Blitzkrieg, which means lightning war in German, was the strategy the Nazi government used to overrun much of Eastern Europe in World War II. The Athletes Commission should do something about it, Mr. Treuger said. We should stop such a thing in the Olympic Village. Good point. But can we leave the only a game part of the shirt as is? I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, equal time for a book entitled More Than Just a Game. But first, the gymnastics competition at the Olympic Games in Athens begins today. For years, women's gymnastics has been producing Olympic heroes, whether Russian, Romanian, or American. One of the most successful gymnasts at the latter category is Shannon Miller, who was the most decorated U.S. athlete at the 1992 Games and who led the U.S. team to a gold medal at the 96 Games in Atlanta. Shannon Miller is in Athens covering gymnastics for NBC. She joins me now by phone. Shannon, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much.
I've been reading your biography, which says that some observers felt that you were too old to compete in your second Olympics in 96. You were 19, but this time around, the U.S. women's team includes two athletes in their mid-20s. Is it fair to conclude this represents a healthy development in women's gymnastics?
Absolutely. It's wonderful to see so many 25-year-olds, 26-year-olds out there. We even have one 29-year-old in the competition and several mothers in the competition, women that have had children and come back to the sport. The U.S. team actually ranges from ages 16 to 26. So it's an incredible spread, and I think it just goes to show that, you know, it doesn't matter what your body type is and how old you are. It's just the love of the sport and how hard you work at it.
Among the more intriguing notes about the members of the U.S. team is the fact that Taryn Humphrey, whose favorite event is the uneven bars, began gymnastics in 1988. She was 2 years old. What does a 2-year-old gymnast do?
I think a lot of gymnasts start in what they call mommy and me classes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great because the, you know, moms or dads can go in with their kids. And it's great because they don't do any skills and they don't know what gymnastics is. But they get some flexibility and some basic coordination skills and a little bit of strength. And it just starts them on the right path of being healthy. You know, whether they end up in gymnastics or at the Olympic Games or not, they're still going to get a great foundation for any sport.
At the 96 Olympics, the U.S. team won a gold medal. That had never happened before. 4 years ago in Sydney, the American team didn't make it to the podium. Are the members of the current team feeling pressure to win gold again, or do you suppose they regard you and your 96 teammates as a kind of once-in-a-lifetime aggregation?
Not at all. I think that they are very capable of winning a gold medal here in Athens. Now, absolutely, it's going to be a struggle, and they're definitely going to have competition from the Romanians, the Russians, the Chinese. But at the same time, I think that they're really looking at it from a new perspective, not can we match the 96 team or can we make a difference from the 2000 team and get on that podium, but just can we just go out there and do our job? You know, can we go out there and do the very best that we can individually and as a team? And then, you know, wherever the chips fall, that's what we're going to be very happy with.
Which members of the current team strike you as the ones with the best chances to win medals?
Wow. Well, I think as a team, they have a tremendous chance. Well, that puts, you know, all of them in medal contention. For the all-around, only two Americans will be allowed to make it, you know, two per country. It's going to be a tough battle between Courtney Kupets, Courtney McCool, and Carly Patterson to who even gets those two spots. And all three of them have a chance at a medal in the all-around. Then, of course, event finals, it's anybody's game. And we're looking two nights from now to see how many events they can even qualify in to have a chance at a medal in those. So we're looking at a lot of medals on the women's side and again, on the men's side as well.
Though teams win medals, the individual gymnasts are obviously on their own each time they compete. To what extent did you and the other gymnasts on the team in 92 and in 96 regard yourselves as a team rather than as a collection of individual performers?
Well, in 96, it was a little bit different than it is now. We really didn't meet up until a couple weeks before the Olympics. And, of course, we always train all over the country, wherever we're living, wherever we grew up usually. We have different coaches. We have a personal coach, so the head coach isn't necessarily even coaching us.
Mm-hmm.
We may be looking out into the audience to our coach. So it really is an individual sport, and you do come together as a team, you know, once or twice a year, but that's really it. This is not, you know, volleyball or basketball where the whole team is on the floor at one time and you really have to know signals and all of that stuff. You really are out there alone. No one's up there on the balance beam with you. No one can help you out once you're on the podium getting ready to go. The team comes into play when you need that leadership or you need that experience or you need someone to ask a question, things like that that will help you out throughout the competition that maybe is not the athletic part, but it's still a big part of the sport and a big part of the Olympic Games.
There's been a lot of discussion about the way the composition of this team was revealed to the world, rather in the manner of a reality TV show. Do you think the athletes themselves enjoyed that spectacle?
I doubt that they enjoyed it. I don't think anyone enjoys the selection part of the Olympic trials and the Olympic selection camp and actually selecting the team, especially those that don't make it. It's obviously a tremendously hard decision to make on both the selection committee's part, but also for the athletes. I mean, you look at us leaving off two world gold medalists
mm-hmm.
off the team completely. And part of them, I think, understands the selection and understands the makeup of the team and how you had to pick and choose. But at the same time, if you're sitting in that alternate spot or you just missed the team, it's devastating. And it's hard, I think, for these girls to have that witnessed on television, their disappointment in all of those years of training. And not that these girls aren't going to go on and do great things. We may see some of them in China in 2008, but at the same time, it is very difficult to have that kind of witnessed with everybody watching their expressions as they learn what happened.
4 years must seem an eternity when you've just missed an Olympic team.
Absolutely. And you know what? I have to admit that I am very lucky. I'm very lucky that I didn't have to go through that. It's a very difficult position to be in, and I've talked to some of the athletes in the past that have been in that position. And on the one hand, you're just so amazed that you even got that far. But on the other hand, it's just like, oh, you know, one toe point away from making it onto the Olympic team. it's got its pluses and minuses, but it's definitely a very tough road.
Which of the gymnasts from other nations are you particularly looking forward to seeing perform?
Oh, wow. I mean, there's a lot of great athletes here individually as well as team, but I think since the team competition is coming up first, the ones we're eyeing right now, of course, are Romania, who are their returning Olympic champions, and they are not happy about losing to us at World Championships, and I'm sure that they've been quite prepared coming into these games. Of course, China and Russia, and I'm very interested to see Svetlana Horkina compete. This will be her last Olympics, and she really, really wants that team gold medal for Russia, and maybe even more than that, the all-around gold medal. It just seems elusive.
Now, I know you haven't been a member of the national team since 1997, but does being at the Olympics there in Athens make you feel as if you'd like to go out there and kind of try some of those events again?
You know, anytime I get into a gym or around a balance beam, I feel like getting out there. But, you know, the skills that these girls are doing, I'm pretty happy to be talking about them this go-round.
Shannon Miller was second in the women's all-round competition at the 92 Olympics in Barcelona. At the 96 Games in Atlanta, she led the U.S. team to a gold medal. She spoke to me from Athens. Shannon, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Columbia University Press is engaged in publishing a series of what it calls interpretive histories focusing on major aspects of the American experience since 1945. The most recent book in the series is entitled More Than Just a Game, Sports in American Life Since 1945. The author is Catherine Jay, Assistant Professor of History and Director of American Studies at Barnard College, Columbia University. She joins me now from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Catherine Jay, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
The subtitle of the book is Sports in American Life Since 1945. What was different before 1945? Why start there?
A couple of reasons. One is the inclusion of African Americans into sports in a significant way into mainstream sports. The other is the invention of TV, ultimately, which I think is the most transformative issue in sports over the past 50 years. And that just didn't exist before 1945.
In 1952, the president of the IOC, Avery Brundage, an American businessman, said, quote, "If the games become contests between hired gladiators of various nations with the idea of proving national prestige, they will lose all meaning." Was he truly concerned, or was that just hot air that came with the office?
He was truly concerned. He was also way behind the times, so that they had already become games between hired gladiators, basically, by 1952. In a sense, I think it's the Cold War tensions that really invigorate the Olympics and really make people pay attention to them and care about them, because it's a way for the United States and the Soviet Union to really fight things out and in a way that's not possible in the Cold War period.
Well, one would certainly hope not, because the alternative to fighting it out on the hockey rink or somewhere else in the athletic arena would be awful.
Exactly.
So you buy that idea that sports in the Olympics legitimately is a way for countries to compete against one another. It shouldn't necessarily be the ideal of each athlete simply doing his or her best.
The Olympics hasn't been that ideal probably since its inception, maybe in the first couple of Olympics, but point tables, though people talk about them, you know, how many points is a gold medal worth and are we winning the Olympics?
Mm-hmm.
People talk about that coming during the Cold War, but nations are keeping count by the early 20s. Clearly, the United States wants to beat England, wants to beat France, even before the Cold War.
Writing about sports during the 60s, you conclude that athletics, quote, provided African Americans with the opportunity for economic advancement and a chance to make a national impact. Did opportunity outweigh exploitation at that point, do you think?
It's really hard to say, because certainly colleges really begin to use African Americans in the 1960s. And very quickly, African Americans on campus begin to realize they're being exploited, that they're there just to help the team, not to get an education, that they'll be discarded if they talk back, if they break the rules, and they'll be discarded once their eligibility is used up, whether they get a degree or not. It's a really fine line. It is a place where African Americans do have a chance to get ahead economically in ways that aren't available to them in other fields. But the exploitation is right there with the economic opportunity.
You tell the story of 9 track athletes at the University of El Paso in 1968 who decided to protest the university's treatment of black athletes. The university suspended the 9 athletes and withdrew their scholarships so they could no longer go to school. Do you have any idea what happened to those athletes in the following years?
Well, Bob Beamon went on to win the long jump in the 1968 Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
So some of them did quite well. That's a story that gets told again and again, that black athletes, especially 68, 69, and 70, began to really speak out against injustices on campus, really drawing on the civil rights and the black power movement. So you can see one part of society drawing on another part of society. Athletes themselves then are so visible, right? We care a lot about basketball. We care a lot about football. So when our athletes start to speak up, more people listen. So it makes an interesting tension between athletes who have a platform now from which to try to speak.
Well, John Carlos and Tommy Smith, of course, are two of the athletes who would qualify as the kind of folks that you're mentioning. It's ironic, I think, that they, of course, were punished, sent away from the games for making the protests they made with their gloved fists. But now they're celebrated.
Right. And it's also important to remember that we counted their medals in the medal count. Right. We sent them home, but those gold medals and those silver medals counted. The other great example is Muhammad Ali, reviled by especially many white Americans in the 60s and is lighting the torch at the Atlantic Olympics in 1996. So ideas about what's happened in the 60s really begin to change.
At the 72 games, Mark Spitz won 7 gold medals and subsequently said, quote, "It's like a game to see how much money I can make. I know I'm lucky, but I also feel entitled to make a buck." Did the expression of that attitude constitute a turning point in the modern games, or was Mark Spitz just following the lead of previous champions who'd perhaps been less frank?
Well, you know, Johnny Weissmuller parlayed his Olympic abilities into being Tarzan in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of crossover, I think, had long been a possibility. Spitz is really on to something, that something changes in the 1970s in terms of athletes being able to sell themselves as athletes and really make a great deal of money from their success. So yes, he's in a long tradition, and things are changing in the 70s in terms of the amount of money that's being poured into sports and the amount of money that athletes can make from sports.
You know, listening to you talk about these developments, what strikes me is that over the years it's gotten perhaps harder and harder for fans to watch the Olympics or any sports just as competition, with all the commercialism and all the other baggage that's come into it.
Right. Although I think one of the most fascinating things about sports for me is that despite all the commercialism, despite all the baggage, despite the drug claims, the drug problems that are going on now and have been going on for generations, fans are willfully innocent and really want to watch it as just a competition between
right.
great athletes. And often they succeed. I mean, that's true for the Olympics. That's true for rooting for your local team. I went to the University of Texas. I root for the Texas Longhorns. I know they cheat. They've been put on probation multiple times. Nevertheless, there could be a magical moment in a game that still transcends all of the problems of the game. There are all sorts of things wrong with American society in general. Sports reflect the basic issues of American society. It's wrong for us, I think, to think that they're going to be perfect or they're going to be this magical world where the problems don't exist. The problems exist, but there's still something that really offers some moment where you can say, wow, that was amazing. That was incredible. And you don't get that a lot in everyday society.
Catherine Jay is the author of More Than Just a Game, Sports in American Life Since 1945, published by Columbia University Press. Professor Jay, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, it was great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, from worst to not quite worst, the journey of the Devil Rays. But first, I'm joined on the line by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Sprinter Tori Edwards has appealed her 2-year suspension, which was handed down this week. Assuming that she loses the appeal, 5-time Olympian Gail Devers will take her spot on the starting line in the 100 meters. Devers is 37 years old. Do you like her chances?
I like Gail Devers as a real kind of plucky teammate. You know, the great odd thing about Gail Devers' career is that she's never won an Olympic gold medal in the event she's most specialized at, which is 110-meter hurdle.
Right.
But here's another chance for her to win another medal in another event.
World Anti-Doping Agency head Dick Pound said this week that Marion Jones will be in, quote, a deep hole if it's found out that she lied when she said she hadn't used banned substances. Jones's attorney fired back by calling Pound's comments, quote, anti-American smears. Given Dick Pound's association with a Salt Lake City game, should he be throwing this sort of stone right now?
Well, this is the way that the World Anti-Doping Agency under Mr. Pound has been playing this. You know, this is a career maker for them, this whole Balco investigation. And this is the way he's been playing it, with, you know, surreptitious leaks and a grand jury that's a sieve and, you know, genuine, authentic, ironclad third-hand hearsay and real-time innuendo. So, yeah, I mean, yes, if she's been lying about it, she's in it. She is in the deep hole. You know, does he have the faintest lick of evidence that she has been? My guess is no, but I have the feeling he just wanted to get the phrase lying out into the press.
The NBA's Board of Governors unanimously approved the sale of the New Jersey Nets to a group led by developer Bruce Ratner. Will the sale be enough to stem the escape of the rest of New Jersey's talented players?
Yeah, they've lost another one. I don't know. This is the whole plan that's kept New York politics all roiled up about the possibility of moving to Brooklyn and so forth. I think that franchise has hit a dead spot out of which it's not going to climb for quite some time.
Although attendance at Major League Baseball games is up 10% over last season, on the eve of the Little League World Series, the word is that Little League participation has fallen off dramatically. More evidence that the Empire is, in fact, in decline?
No, I don't know. I think maybe it's the salary cap. I don't know. You know, people have been saying for years that the interest among young kids in baseball has been falling off. Little League, because they do have their big tournament at the end of the year that's nationally televised, always seem to be just a bit immune from that, at least to the casual fan who only sees them when they show them on TV. You know, the Little Leagues around the country, they're expensive propositions. They require a great deal of time on behalf of volunteers. And with everybody in this country working 70 hours a week this year, I'm not surprised they can't find coaches and umpires and so forth.
Even as interest in Little League declines, Bud Selig et al. Are working on arrangements for a baseball World Cup. What do you think?
I like this idea. I hope this is completely contrary to the way we do things in sports, but I really hope they only do this once, because I think once it could be a very cool thing. I think it would be tremendously charming to watch the Dominicans play for the Dominican Republic, or the Cubans play for the Cubans, or the Panamanians play for the Panamanians. Yeah, I think it's a terrific idea. I really do.
Meanwhile, contrary to Commissioner Bud's earlier announcement that he thought he might retire at the end of the current term, it looks like he will continue to serve.
Well, yes, they're going to extend his contract, so he'll have more to pay his lawyers back in Wisconsin, I think.
In Major League action, Charlie, on Tuesday night, Adam Dunn of the Cincinnati Reds hit a home run out of Great American Ballpark into the Ohio River. And my question is, if it made it into the middle of the river, hence landing in Kentucky, would that make it the first interstate home run?
Well, more to the point, what if it hit into the middle of the river and it caught in a current and was followed all the way to the Mississippi and is soon floating in the Caribbean and washes up in,
I love it.
You know, washes up in the Lesser Antilles or someplace?
An intercontinental home
there
run.
There we are. It'll expand your mind in these concepts, Bill.
Last week, we discussed Donald Trump's ascendance to spokesperson for the U.S. Open. This week, the rationale for his taking the job became clear. Mr. Trump's casino business is going into bankruptcy. Do you think the tennis gig will cover the Donald's debts and expenses?
It's hard to believe that an industry based on the fundamental financial degradation of human beings would ever run into money trouble. Look, he may be even good at running the U.S. Open. Who knows? It's a tournament that needs a little bit of flash and dash. I certainly don't have a problem with him being there.
John McEnroe has demonstrated that being a former tennis champion doesn't mean people will watch when you have conversations with other people on TV. The program he hosts recently earned a 0.0 rating. Does that mean literally nobody was watching?
No, I know that's not true because I watched.
They had
Keith and Aaron Smart from the United States fencing team on a couple weeks ago, and I watched the show.
There you go.
So somebody, why? You can't have a zero rating. I watched.
How was the show, by the way?
It was, you know, a talk show. McEnroe was handed a saber, and he used it left-handed. So he is thoroughgoing left-handed now, we know.
A night of hockey fights planned for an arena in Winnipeg has been squelched by the police there, Charlie. The authorities failed to see the humor or the socially redeeming value of an event that would feature hockey players fighting each other without actually having to play hockey. Is the NHL in bigger trouble than we'd thought?
Well, it might be if somebody gets the bright idea that this is a way to have the NHL without having the NHL next year.
And finally, Charlie, 350 kids in Germany attacked each other last Saturday with 7,850 water balloons, which organizers say will certainly be recognized by the Guinness World Record book folks. Pretty impressive, don't you think?
It was very impressive, especially when they all got together, filled up the water balloons again, and then went after France.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and bursts many balloons of his own each week here on Only the Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
At the end of the July 31st edition of Only a Game, we inadvertently frustrated Terry Contas, who wrote, "Please tell me the name of that song played during the credits. It's real familiar to me, but I can't place it, and I'm going slightly bonkers." The song, which followed Judith Ritter's story on Elephant Polo, was Baby Elephant Walk by Renee Touzet. Regarding that story, Leah Glovsky, a Boston listener, wrote, "What an extraordinary report. I would like to hear more about a sport in which a rather large animal, a driver, and a player can each determine the play of the ball. Can you do a follow-up to that story?" If we did, we'd probably dismay Michael Wells, a Vermont Public Radio listener, who couldn't believe that Only a Game didn't feature a story on the end of the Tour de France. "Yes, the show is quirky and offbeat to your great credit," Mr. Wells wrote, "but come on, folks, we expect some coverage of the great events, as well as elephant polo." What can I say? Get Lance on a pachyderm, we'll do the story, and he'll probably win. Regarding my conversation last week with Michael Sokolov, who wrote the New York Times Magazine cover story about Olympic swimmer Michael Phelps, Jerry Kalagian, a WBUR listener, wrote, "When Mr. Sokolov described the physicality of Mr. Phelps, he described the symptoms of Marfan syndrome, a potentially deadly genetic disorder. Mr. Kalagian also wrote the New York Times and urged Michael Phelps to, quote, have himself checked out by a knowledgeable physician for his own long-term well-being." Jay Garfield, a professor who hears Only a Game on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, wrote, "I have been dismayed at your lack of coverage of a major quadrennial tournament, the World Ultimate Frisbee Championships, held this year in Turku, Finland." And finally, in response to Karen Given's story last week on the proposed motorsports club in Tamworth, New Hampshire, Raul Dominguez wrote, "I am a car racing purist, and I hope that Club Motorsports Incorporated can convince the good people of Tamworth, New Hampshire, to accept the track. They should check Lime Rock in Connecticut to see a wonderful track in a hamlet setting." Email your suggestions and comments to us by visiting the website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. Comments addressed to Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215 will also reach us, albeit more slowly. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
Look, I've got to have confidence as a manager, and I've got to exude that confidence to my players and to the community where the team plays.
In the visitors' dugout at Fenway Park on Tuesday afternoon, Tampa Bay Devil Rays manager Lou Piniella was not backing off his preseason prediction that for the first time in the team's short and less than glorious history, the Rays would not finish last. A forecast he offered before the 2004 season began.
It's easy for me as a manager to say, well, we finished last 6 years in a row. I think we've improved somewhat, but the division's awfully tough. Maybe we can finish in last place a little more solidly than we did last year, and maybe we can win a few more games. Now, who in the hell is that going to excite? Nobody, right?
I understand.
My job is to let the players know that I like the ball club. Let the community know that I like the ball club so that they can get a little baseball excitement.
The previous night in Fenway Park, the Rays had generated more than a little baseball excitement by hitting four home runs and knocking Curt Schilling, who has won 13 games for the Red Sox this season, out of the game. It was not an altogether uncharacteristic performance for the Rays, a team which, according to center fielder Rocco Baldelli, discovered back in June that it could be pretty good.
Well, I think, you know, we went into interleague play this year and we were struggling a little bit. And once we hit that interleague play, I mean, shoot, we ended up winning 12 in a row. And, you know, we won, I don't know if it was 40 out of 60 or something crazy like that. But, you know, we kind of proved to ourselves that we can do this. We can win ball games and, you know, hopefully we can keep it up to the end of the year.
Rocco Baldelli, 22, is hitting over .280 in his second season with the Rays. He'd be the team's designated young star, except for various other children on the roster, some of them shining even more brightly than Baldelli. Left fielder Carl Crawford, 23, is regarded as potentially one of the 10 best players in the game. Then there's shortstop B.J. Upton, who's 19. Rocco Baldelli says he and his teammates have learned not to worry about playing against guys whose baseball cards they still collect.
Yeah, it's not a big deal for us. I mean, our organization isn't afraid to bring up, you know, 19, 20, 21-year-old kids and, you know, throw them out on the field and you know, they want to see what you've got. So it's pretty nice. You know, if you play for a team like Boston or New York, you might not get that opportunity for a while. You might be in the minor leagues, stuck there for a while.
What Rocco Baldelli perceives as an opportunity, Devil Rays manager Lou Piniella sees as a necessity.
We've had to rush kids in this organization, including our left fielder Crawford, including our center fielder Baldelli, and that's really going to be the case with Upton. So we're going to have to live with some mistakes, but at the same time, we see good upside potential and good growth, and we'll give him experience. And then we'll see where he's at next spring, whether he can win a job on a regular basis or not.
Piniella, who previously managed the Seattle Mariners and skippered the Cincinnati Reds to a world championship before that, also feels bringing young players into a lineup can sometimes have immediate benefits.
Well, it's fun for me to watch young kids play. I have always been a manager. If you check my 18 years, we have always given a lot of young pitchers and a lot of young players opportunities. I think the danger of an organization is getting old at once, and now you got a nowhere-to-go situation, and you got a club that is satisfied and not quite as hungry. So when you can inject a young player or two a year, you're keeping it fresh.
Brave words, but everybody knows a successful baseball team needs experience, too. For that, the manager need look no further than the man who sits beside him in the dugout.
Well, they gave me a job, and it was 12 minutes from my house, and I said, how can it be any better?
Don Zimmer became available to Tampa Bay when he quit his job as bench coach with the Yankees last year over a disagreement with owner George Steinbrenner. Zimmer's career in the big leagues began 50 years ago this season. He says now he's not a coach because the Devil Rays already have six coaches. He characterizes himself instead as, quote, a helper. Sometimes he sounds more like a cheerleader.
There's no question. I would say that it'll be a disappointment here if we don't win more games than they've ever won before, because I don't think the club's ever won 70 games. We would have to go pretty bad right now not to, you know, win more games than the Devil Rays have ever won.
For the record, Don Zimmer is right. The Devil Rays never have won more than 69 games, though they've made it to 69 twice. Don Zimmer knows something about staying optimistic, even under trying circumstances. He played for the original New York Mets, and he finished his career as a Washington Senator. He also played for the Dodgers when they were still in Brooklyn, so he's qualified to give the kids playing for the Devil Rays a baseball history lesson. Though Tampa Tribune baseball writer Carter Gaddis thinks for these students, maybe geography should precede history.
Well, first they'll have to know where Brooklyn is, because some of these kids get on the 4 train and go the wrong direction. I mean, it actually happened last year up down in New York, but Don Zimmer has been a fun addition to this ball club. I mean, he's a guy that brings so much knowledge and has so many stories. And oddly enough, the young ball players look at him and they don't see this grizzled old guy. They see this wellspring of information.
Despite the fact that Don Zimmer accumulated some of that wellspring of information managing the Red Sox from 1976 through 1980, his experience and advice could not make up for the lack of pitching and hitting while the Devil Rays were in Boston. Tampa Bay ended up losing 3 of 4. Still, the Rays have managed to put some distance between themselves and the cellar they have called home since their creation in 1998. The Toronto Blue Jays have been cooperating in Tampa Bay's attempted relocation. The quest for residents on an even more preferable floor, if not quite yet in the penthouse, continues tonight in Arlington, Texas, where Tampa Bay will play the Rangers. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director this week was Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Tampa Bay Devil Ray and 50-year baseball veteran Don Zimmer.
I'm not a coach. I'm just kind of a helper. That's all I am.
Don, don't sell yourself short. You're a widely read author and a Zen master, according to the title of your most recent book. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.